KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Surrounding the Skagit River Bridge, investigators are on the scene working to determine how the collapse happened. Travis Phelps of the Washington Department of Transportation says it is not an issue of the bridge being too old or structurally unsound. He says it has to do with the fact it was struck by an oversized load last night.
This could happen to any new, even a new bridge. This isn't a design issue per se. If you have a brand new bridge, you strike it at freeway speeds with a multi-ton object, you're going to see a catastrophic failure. Just like we saw on I-5 in Skagit County.
The trucking company involved in the collapse says it received a state-issued permit to carry its oversized load across the bridge. An official with Mellon Trucking of Alberta, Canada, says they are not sure the truck was the cause. That span carries about 70,000 cars and trucks a day. Transportation officials recommending several detours or advising drivers to avoid the area altogether for the next few weeks. The situation is hitting home for many who live and work near the bridge in the Mount Vernon area. The city's mayor, Jill Boudreau, says they're not sure right now how those extra cars and trucks will fare on Mount Vernon streets.
That would be a significant issue for us. We've got our busiest intersection in town handles about 40,000 cars a day. So, you know, adding significantly more is going to be an issue. So, like I said, we're really working on the three different exits, that exit I-5 into Mount Vernon, and how we can really guide people around this closure.
Both Mayor Boudreau and Travis Phelps spoke with KUOW's Marcy Silman on weekday. You will be able to hear the entire interview online. I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
.53 and overcast right now in Seattle's University District. It's going to be mostly cloudy today with a 40% chance of showers, a high of 59. It'll be cloudy tonight with some rain possible. Expect a low around 48. Support for NPR comes from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Los Angeles reduced emissions for its entire bus fleet by switching to natural gas. Thinkaboutit.org. I'm Rob Wood. Warren Olney talks about the psychiatric designations in the psychiatry manual DSM-5 coming up in an hour. On To The Point. 94.9 KUOW, it's 10:06.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The National Transportation Safety Board is launching an investigation into last night's I-5 bridge collapse. A semi-truck carrying an oversized load hit one of the support beams on the bridge, which collapsed into the Skagit River, along with two vehicles. Nobody was killed. Yesterday, King 5 Television spoke with one of the survivors outside Skagit Valley Hospital.
Things happen so fast, it's hard to even... It's like a Hollywood movie unfolding right in front of you, live, up close and personal. When we saw the truck approaching the bridge, you notice the wide load sign. You notice the structure on the back of the truck. And when it started to approach it, my wife and I started commenting on it looked like it was 3 or 4 feet wider than the actual bridge. Anytime you want to come over left to get it onto the road, it's okay with us. You know, just a little chatter between us. And at the last minute, there was a second semi that came up on the left side, it appeared. Like it almost pinned that truck in from being able to come over left. At that point, the wide load caught the right side of the bridge. There was a loud boom, a big puff of dust, it appeared. The truck somehow made it across that span as we locked up the brakes and went right off the edge of the bridge into the Skagit River with the whole section. Hit the water, hit solid something, which I assume was the asphalt on the bridge. And as I came to, felt the water rushing in to mid-belly region. I put the truck in park, emergency brake, kept asking my wife if she's okay, did not get a response from her, and noticed that my shoulder was pretty well dislocated, couldn't reach to get my seatbelt undone, somehow wiggled and got my shoulder back into place for me to be able to get up and crawl underneath the collapsed overhead of the truck between my wife and I, and I looked underneath to see how she was doing. She was out cold, semi. Was touching her on the face a little bit and asking her if she was okay. Could she move her legs, arms? Were you bleeding? She was kind of hysterical. I noticed that side of the truck was in deeper water, and I knew I had to get her over onto my side where I pulled her underneath, got her into the driver's side, which allowed me to step out onto the side rail of the truck, which is about upper calf, lower knee region in the skadit there, and just stood on the side of the truck. When I looked around, I noticed that there was a guy in another car. I couldn't even tell if it was upside down or not, crawling out of a window. Asked him if he was okay. He said yes. He asked me if I was okay. I said yes. He commented I was bleeding. I said, yeah, I'm okay. And he asked him if there was a car next to him, which looked like something was in the water. He said he couldn't tell. So we assumed we were the only two in the water at this point.
That's one of the survivors of last night's collapse of the I-5 bridge over the Skagit River. He spoke with King 5 Television outside Skagit Valley Hospital. KUW's transportation reporter Derek Wong is in Mount Vernon this morning. Derek, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
So, first of all, I'm curious, how long did it take you to get from Seattle to Mount Vernon?
I think it took me maybe 90 minutes. I honestly have forgotten by now.
But it's crowded. Traffic's bad.
Traffic, once you get to town, it's a little backed up just because of the detour.
Now, I understand that a lot of folks heard the accident happen. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. Earlier this morning, I spoke with a couple. They live about 2 miles away from the scene, and they heard this large metal crash, and they thought it was their neighbor moving some metal furniture. They said it sounded like, a lot of refrigerators being knocked over, but it obviously turned it. Then they turned on the TV, and it turned out that it was actually the bridge collapsing. Other people in town heard about this. There was a high school award ceremony yesterday, and word quickly spread over social media with all the high school students, and they were telling their parents during their award ceremony that the bridge had collapsed, and some of the high schoolers are emergency responders, so they had to cut the award ceremony short so everyone could rush out to the scene.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm also standing next to a couple that has lived here for 40 years. If you'd like to talk to them, Marcy.
I would. You want to tell me who I'm going to speak with?
Sure. I can pass you over to Colleen Nelson. She's lived here for 45 years, and her husband, Richard, is also with us, and he's lived here his whole life, 74 years. So I'll first pass you over to Colleen Nelson.
Okay, thank you.
Hello?
Hi, Colleen. Thanks for being with us. Where were you last night when the bridge collapsed?
I had actually just gotten back from Seattle. I was going to Costco and changed my mind, and I got home. Oh, it was about 6:35, and then shortly after that, the phone rang, and we have 8 kids, and so they're going, Mom, Dad, are you okay? Are you home? We were getting texts, and the phone was ringing. Everybody was checking in because we used the bridge so much living here.
How close do you live to the bridge?
Pardon?
How close do you live to the bridge?
Oh, well, we're probably about 5 miles out of town. We live between Big Lake and Clear Lake. But anytime we come into town, we're going over the bridge.
Did you ever have any worries crossing that bridge?
Never. But I never think of those things.
That's a good thing. You're standing right at the bridge right now, or where the remains of the bridge, right?
Correct.
Can you tell me what you're looking at?
I'm looking at twisted, terribly twisted metal, and the girders, and I'm seeing the tops of the cars, and feeling how lucky and how terrified. What a horrible experience. I really thought, oh no, there's more cars. They just haven't seen them. It's getting dark. And if they had gone into the water, there's, with our river here, it does have quite a current. And other times cars have rolled underneath the water. And I kept thinking, oh, there's some cars and they just haven't spotted them yet. If it had been at 5 o'clock, it probably would have been really a huge disaster.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an infrastructure disaster, but the fact that everybody was safe, we just listened to some tape that King 5 Television collected last night from one of the survivors. It's kind of remarkable, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Unbelievable. It is. I still can't believe that they were all able to escape. And that couple, you know, he had to hold his wife up above the water, and, you know, and she was not conscious. So, yes, it is. It's a sight to see. I mean, it looks the same as on TV, but when you're here, you just kind of take it in a different way.
I'm sure. Can you pass the phone to your husband now?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to us, Colleen.
Hello.
Hi. So you've lived in the Mount Vernon area for more than 70 years, is that right?
For 74 years, born and raised here.
And nothing like this has ever happened, I'm assuming.
No. One time a car went on a side road to the bridge, went down in the river, and they could see the headlights. The kid got out okay, but that's about it.
How does this affect you, your daily life?
Not a whole lot, because we know the area, we know the side roads to get around, and so it's not going to affect us a whole lot.
We talked with the mayor of Mount Vernon about an hour ago, and she said that a lot of the merchants in the downtown area in particular are a little bit worried about traffic being diverted from I-5 through all the neighborhoods in your town.
We were just over at Walmart, and the place was empty. And they got all these sales going on, and, you know, and they were kind of concerned about that because there was no one in the store.
Yeah, I imagine that a lot of people who might come down perhaps from Canada to shop or up from Seattle are not going to be driving through Mount Vernon anytime soon.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, you take care, and if you could pass the telephone back to our reporter, Derek.
Okay.
Thanks for talking with us.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Hi, Marcy.
Hi, Derek. So we have a couple of questions from listeners. Sue wants to know if this particular bridge collapse affects the Amtrak trains.
I don't believe this affects the Amtrak train. This is only a part of I-5.
And another question that I'm pretty sure I know the answer to, but maybe you know something else. Janie emails, obviously the bridge wasn't safe to cross before this accident happened. But as far as I understand it, while the bridge was narrower than usual and of a particular type of construction, there was no flaw in the bridge itself. It didn't have a crack. It's not like the Alaskan Way Viaduct.
That's my understanding as well. I haven't actually checked the records of this bridge. I have heard, which I'm sure we've all heard, Transportation Secretary Lynn Peterson saying this bridge was inspected fairly recently, I think twice in the past year, which would indicate that the state believed it was safe to drive on.
Yeah. Well, Derek, I'm going to let you get about your business, and we'll be hearing your reports throughout the day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcy.
That's KOW's transportation reporter, Derek Wong, who's in Mount Vernon this morning. And just a reminder, if you are just tuning into a news report and you haven't heard this yet, a bridge over I-5 over the Skagit River at Mount Vernon collapsed last night. Nobody was injured in that accident, but it's going to be many weeks before the bridge itself is repaired. Traffic between Seattle and Vancouver, or Seattle and Bellingham, or if you're going to the San Juan Islands, you are going to have to go find yourself a different route because you are not going to be traveling on I-5. We're going to take a short break and be back with our panel of journalists here on Weekday on KUOW.
KUOW. It's 10:18.
Support for KUOW comes from Broadway at the Paramount, presenting Fela, celebrating the music of a man who introduced modern African music to a generation and helped shape the politics of a continent. Running May 28th through June 2nd at the Paramount Theater. Tickets and information at stgpresents.org.
We have 52 degrees with overcast conditions this morning in Seattle's University District. Should be mostly cloudy for the rest of the day. We're looking at about a 40% chance of some showers. this afternoon. Expect a high around 59. It'll be cloudy with rain possible tonight, a low of 48. And tomorrow should be mostly cloudy. There's a slight chance of some more rain with a high of about 63 degrees.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Kongsgaard Goldman Foundation, the Cape Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
I'm Rob Wood. Just a reminder, we'll continue to have updates for you throughout the day on the I-5 bridge collapse at the Skagit River here on 94.9 KUOW.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, Steve Scher, on sabbatical till October. Well, we've heard about the collapse of the bridge. There are so many momentous things happening this week that we wanted to bring our panel of journalists in to talk about. And we have a guest journalist, always happy to see Erica C. Barnett, who's news editor at Publicola at Seattle Met. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Also with us, Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, and Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. Did you guys hear about this bridge collapse last night? Because you're more tuned in to me as opposed to sleeping at 8 o'clock at night, which is where I was.
Well, I envy you the sleep at 8 o'clock. But yes, I heard about it last night. It was all over Twitter and some really amazing pictures on Twitter and then pretty quickly on the news and Slog and everywhere else that you would be looking.
You know, it's interesting. I was reading those couple of emails from listeners and the assumption was, and Erica, you were saying in that break there, that there was something wrong with this bridge. And I think it was just that we have in engineering standards surpassed the design of that bridge.
Well, the thing that was wrong with it is that it's, what, like 60 years old?
Almost.
And, you know, we traditionally replace bridges after, you know, 50 years or whatever their lifespan is. And so, I mean, it sounds like there's a pretty big design flaw if, you know, your bridge collapses when a truck hits it.
There's a I'm not sure where I saw this, maybe on the Seattle Times website, but WashDOT has a list of structurally suspect bridges, which there are dozens of bridges on this list. I don't know if any of you looked at that. And I don't believe at this point in time the state has any money to replace any bridges. The governor did sign a transportation budget, but he didn't, he decided not to include replacing the bridge that goes from Vancouver, Washington to Portland, which
needs to be replaced.
It does need to be replaced, but the thing that he vetoed was a proposal by Republicans to fund yet another study of the bridge because they don't want the low crossing. They say that the Coast Guard, is that it's going to hurt business traffic down the river. But Inslee is pushing pretty hard for a revenue package, which is still in play in the legislature, $8.7 billion, and it's a very maintenance-heavy package. And I think this actually, you know, paradoxically kind of helps the chances of that package because it's, you know, such a concrete demonstration of the need.
Well, I'm not even sure if the South Park Bridge has any kind of date to be opened anytime soon. They've been working on that forever.
It's set to be open in 2014.
So that, I think, was in addition to the viaduct, the most faulty bridge. I think it is called the structurally faulty bridge list is the official name of it.
Well, one thing you can see, bridges are are problematic. I mean, they're solving a problem, with a gap or and dealing with gravity or in the case of floating bridges, tides and mm-hmm. windstorms and whatnot. And they're expensive to replace. And they also create a tremendous amount of inconvenience when they're replaced, or when they, and certainly when they fall down, they create a lot of inconvenience and a lot of necessity of improvising. I want to just put in a plug for the series that Doug McDonald, the former state transportation head, did for Crosscut just last week.
Right.
And he had a whole section just on the problem with I-5 and its bridges and flood problems on I-5. He's been very critical of the House proposal, transportation proposal in Olympia, because there is maintenance and repair money, but it only represents maybe 11 or 12% of the budget and not a real commitment. And I-5 is in terms of the fixes on I-5. You know, he's saying if you're looking, the big mega project we should all be doing is I-5. You have seismic issues for one thing, so we're not even talking about the vulnerability of these bridges. So much of what we've learned about the seismic destiny of this region has only been learned in the last 20 to 25 mm-hmm. years. And what we know now is very scary. So that's just on its own one issue. But you also have these older pieces, as Erica was mentioning, these old pieces of infrastructure that are carrying, what, 70,000 cars a day. We've got to do something about it, and it's going to take a revamping of the transportation plan to focus on maintenance and replacement and repair as opposed to building new highways that we don't need.
Our listener, Tony, said to remind people the Amtrak bridge is separate from the I-5 bridge, and Amtrak is a good alternative if you want to go to Canada at this point because otherwise, you're going to have a really incredibly scenic tour either way you go, if you take 99 or if you go up through the Cascade foothills. You mentioned inconvenience. This could have been a whole lot worse than an infrastructural inconvenience. I mean, we're very lucky.
Yeah, it's really incredible. I mean, it's incredible that so few cars went in. Anybody who's driven that stretch of road, and certainly we have a holiday weekend coming up. The traffic up there is, can get really crazy on Memorial Day weekend. It's amazing these folks, there were so few that went in the water and that they apparently all came out alive. So,
well, we were listening to the survivor interview from King 5 TV, and Erica, you were remarking how sort of together he was and so observant.
And extremely detailed. Yeah, I've never experienced anything like that in my life, but I've certainly been in, accidents and, bike wrecks and things like that. And man, you can't remember that kind of stuff. I mean, he was on it. And that's probably a big reason his wife survived. I mean, he just immediately jumped into action.
Yeah.
I think I read that he was from a nearby Air Force base. So it sounded like he had that kind of military focus in an emergency, and that probably helped.
You know, we were talking about bridges, and I'm not remembering exactly how many years ago they had to shut the university bridge because there was this big water leak that they were worried was undermining undermining the pilings of these bridges. Our bridges in Seattle are very old for the most part.
Yeah, and as the viaduct shows, it's really hard to get rid of a bridge or or repair a bridge or wire around a bridge. We've had experiences of and these inconveniences. It's interesting. I mean, we lost one of the floating bridges in a storm.
I remember that I-90 bridge.
People on the commuters had to figure out a kind of a whole different way for a while to get around. So.
And I think the Magnolia Bridge, speaking of Seattle bridges, is one of those structurally. I don't know if WashDOT ranks Seattle bridges, but I think
they're
it's pretty far.
There.
I think it's pretty far down the list.
We were also reminiscing earlier about when the freighter crashed into the old West Seattle Bridge, and it basically right. cut West Seattle off from the rest of Seattle, and created a huge problem for people getting from West Seattle to Seattle. It lasted years, and one of the solutions was building the current West Seattle Bridge, which they built high and arcing mm-hmm. so that no ship would ever hit it, and it didn't have to be a drawbridge. But I remember talking to Phil Talmadge about the funding of that, and he was a young legislator at the time, and this was when Warren G. Magnuson was still in the Senate. And he said, that the state of Washington only had to pay something like 10% of the replacement cost because Magnuson just stuck it in a earmark somewhere and got it the replacement of it funded. We're also in an era where the resources to
right.
Do this kind of thing are much less.
Well, I was going to ask you, Erica, since you are the ears in City Hall, transportation funding and what that money goes to seems like it's emerging as one of the issues in this upcoming mayor's race.
Well, I think certainly funding for Metro is, and not that the city controls Metro, but I think that has been a huge issue. And in fact, all the city council members have been down in Olympia continuously. Although, interestingly, I was talking to Tom Rasmussen the other day, and he said that he's sort of backing off on lobbying for Metro funding and letting the suburban cities take over that function, because this is the first time that we've seen the suburbs, the east side suburbs, sort of unite with Seattle and say, we really need this revenue package to go through, because if it doesn't, Metro is not going to have a funding option and they're going to have to cut 17%. So it's a huge issue.
David Goldstein pointed out on Slog that 70,000, the number of people who go over the bridge that collapsed every day, is the number of trips or number of rides that would be slashed from Metro.
Really?
This funding doesn't come through. And so it's just another way of thinking about the urgency of that issue.
So what, just to recap, what Dow Constantine and county and suburban and Seattle legislators are asking Olympia is to allow King County to raise the motor vehicle excise tax, to not, there's no funds that would come from Olympia. It's for us
Correct.
To tax ourselves.
Yep. Yeah, one of the ways the bridge collapse is already kind of echoing in the mayor's race is that some of the candidates, well, Tim Burgess, who
is
no longer a candidate, who dropped out last week, had a sort of let's fix it first sort of orientation. But there was an interview in the Seattle Times yesterday from Peter Steinbrück talking about how we needed transportation priorities that were maintenance and repair oriented. And he was criticizing Mike McGinn's support of a new bridge over the Ship Canal that would carry an as yet unfunded trolley system or streetcar system. And you know, using that to sort of highlight the difference between, you know, somebody wanting to spend money on something that's kind of pie in the sky versus fixing what we have beneath our wheels right now.
We're talking over the week's news with Knute Berger of Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine, Erica C. Barnett, news editor from Public Colette, Seattle Met, and Eli Sanders of The Stranger. And so much happened this week. We're focusing on bridges because that's immediate. But Knute just mentioned Tim Burgess not, I guess the news is, that he didn't enter the mayor's race after being in the mayor's race. That happened last Friday. But I'm going to take us back a week. Erica, you're at City Hall all the time. Were you surprised? Or did you know that this was what he was planning?
I was pretty surprised. But I think, you know, on Thursday, he took this bizarre move of firing his campaign spokesman. And then sort of, so he kind of kept himself in the negative news cycle for 2 days when he didn't need to. And, you know, he has been kind of performing, he's been lackluster at debates. You know, he's been kind of taking a backseat to the other candidates. I think he has not gotten the business support or did not get the business support that he wanted. And I hear that he also did not poll well among women, which is, you know, which is a problem. I mean, you know, 50% of voters, maybe more than that in the primary.
Yeah.
So I wasn't, I mean, I was surprised but not shocked.
But I thought initially his name was always mentioned as, you know, one of the top three. And was that just not the case after these debates started?
Apparently not. I mean, I think he realized he couldn't win. And, you know, he has a colleague in the race, Bruce Harrell. I don't know how much that is a factor. I don't know if people really are aware of who the city council is, or, you know, if that mattered. But I think he just realized he couldn't win and he quit.
He was very clearly the anti-McGinn in the
right.
city before the mayor's race really started going. But once a number of people got into it, there were a lot of anti-McGinns, and at the same time, McGinn was moving to neutralize basically everything that Burgess put forward as a criticism, from the sensible policing strategies that Burgess talked about to everything else. And so he kind of took Burgess's campaign material out from under him in a lot of ways. And then also the fact that Burgess had so many people, including, as Erica said, a council colleague with him in the race against McGinn, split the mm-hmm. kind of anti-McGinn at all costs vote. And I just didn't see him, you know, finding a way to climb back out of that problem.
Two things in the wake of Tim Burgess's decision. One is that former Governor Gregoire threw her support behind Ed Murray. But the other is that I believe Bruce Harrell has come out swinging. I know he was at your offices at Crosscut. He's appeared kind of everywhere. You guys have talked to him at Publicola, and he's just sort of, you know, from a guy that you only heard from sometimes, he's sort of hard charging.
Yeah, he's been great at the debates. Just, I mean, fantastic. And I didn't see that coming because, in his campaign for council, he was not always the most eloquent speaker. You know, he kind of did this like I'm a regular guy thing, and it kind of made him look a little dumb. And now, I mean, he is sharp. He is funny. He's on point. There was, there were some questions that at the 37th District debate or the Southeast Seattle debate mm-hmm. that, you know, he was kind of the only one who had an answer. I guess he's just been coached really well, or, you know, or he really wants it. But he is definitely, if you see him on the stump, you will see a different person than what we think of as Bruce Harrell.
Did you see him when he came to Crosscut?
Yeah, I did. And I saw him the previous night at the 37th District. I've seen him a couple times out. He's very effective. He has very specific. It's interesting when you talk to him about education or you talk to him about different issues. He doesn't talk about, oh, well, the city should take over the schools. He has, you know, two or three policy ideas as to what the city can do to support education. He comes off as, I think, much more thoughtful than people were giving him credit for, and very passionate, intense. This is a guy who really, you know, he has a deep kind of belief in social justice but he also has, and he is consciously going to try and pick up some of the kind of conservative corporate support to the extent you can say it's a vacuum that Burgess left. Because he'll talk about being, you know, fiscally conservative or fiscally responsible. I don't like to waste money. I'm an efficiency guy. So it's an interesting package of sort of social justice with a kind of business conservatism or management conservatism around it. I wanted to go back and make a point about Burgess. I think one of the problems was, you know, his team got together. They looked at the poll numbers, and and the path to victory was going to be expensive for him. He was running a lackluster campaign, and he was going to have to find a way to push past the others. He was getting recommendations of spending a lot of money on TV early. And the problem was he was starting to have a fund. You know, he was thought of as a fundraiser because he'd raised so much money.
Mm-hmm.
But he was starting to lose donors. Some of them were unhappy over they thought he was going soft on South Lake Union. And they started some Charlie Stadecker, who's not considered a serious candidate, but who's raised a lot of money from the development community, was starting to steal some of it. So when he was looking, I think when Burgess was looking at what he was going to have to do to get through the primary, he couldn't afford it.
Well, and I think exactly. I think he would have had to put his own money in the race. And quite a bit of it. I mean, last time I think he put something like $80,000 into his race for city council. And I mean,
this was going to cost a lot.
This was going to cost a lot more than that.
What happens to all the money that Burgess has? Because he has a significant amount of money left now that he's dropped out.
Didn't he say he was going to give it back?
He says he's going to give it back.
Okay. The other interesting thing in the mayor's race was the poll that came out post Burgess leaving that showed McGinn, if I'm remembering right, at something like 22%,
right,
with 23% of people undecided, but McGinn in the lead. And so once again, that phenomenon of 22%, that's pretty...
puts undecided in the lead.
I guess so. But that's not a strong endorsement of any of the other candidates that have gotten in. People are so on the fence, even though we've had a number of highly qualified people running against McGinn for quite some time. The undecideds will begin to get off the fence. I think in the last poll, it was like 33% undecided. But we're seeing again this phenomenon of 22%, which is kind of McGinn's ceiling of approval in the city over the last few months, is enough at this point.
Well, it might be enough to get him through the primary. But,
right.
Well, I will point out, though, that Greg Nichols at this point had 29%. 4 years ago and in the last mayoral election.
He did not
make it through the primary.
No, he did not.
Yeah, those numbers, I mean, for one thing, the margin of error in that poll is, what, 4.3% or something. So, essentially, they're almost all tied, which is interesting. In other words, the you can plus or minus 4% on any of those numbers, and they start to bunch up. I was talking to somebody who had looked at the detail of that poll, and he said one interesting thing, and this goes back to something Erica brought up, which was the gender deal. The only candidate leading among women is Steinbrück, and undecided. The undecided vote is heavily women,
and that's kind of typical. But I was surprised by the Steinbrück support among women too.
Yeah, I think that suggests where somebody's going to have to direct some campaign strategy.
We're going to take a quick break. Knute Berger, Erica C. Barnett, and Eli Sanders are here talking over the week's news. I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday.
KUOW, it's 1039.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW-Bothell Technology MBA program and the Leadership MBA program at Bellevue, featuring small classes and interactive learning environments. Now accepting applications for this fall. Details at uwb.edu/MBA.
We have 53 degrees with overcast conditions this morning in the U District. It's going to be mostly cloudy for the rest of the day. We're looking at about a 40% chance of showers and a high today of about 59. See some more clouds roll in tonight with rain possible, a low around 48. It'll be mostly cloudy tomorrow, slight chance of some more rain, a high near 63. And Sunday calls for partly sunny skies, maybe a little bit of rain. We'll have a high of about 68.
Who got a speeding ticket for going 12 miles an hour?
What is Culatello, and why are you going to eat it?
And why do Rockers Fits in the Tantrums want you to dress like this?
Shoulder pads, everybody. Shoulder pads.
For protection, I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
And I'm Rico Galliano. All these questions answered, plus cocktail recipes and more, on this week's The Dinner Party Download.
The show that helps you win your dinner party.
Hear that tomorrow in the noon hour here on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net.
I'm Rob Wood. Secretary of State John Kerry's meeting with Israeli and Palestinian officials in a bid to revive Mideast peace talks. We'll get the latest on that and on last night's I-5 bridge collapse in the headlines at 11:01 here on 94.9 KUOW.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and we are talking over the week's news with our panel of journalists, who include this week Erica C. Barnett, news editor from Publicola at Seattle Met, Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, and Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com. And yesterday, by an overwhelming majority, leaders of the Boy Scouts of America voted to allow gay youth to participate in Scouts, to lift a ban. Actually, what they did was vote to lift a ban on gay youth participating. And Eli Sanders, in the break, am I allowed to say that you were a gay Boy Scout?
Sure. I was a gay Eagle Scout.
And were you an openly gay Eagle Scout, or was this in the don't ask, don't tell? Did you know?
I wasn't out at the time, so I guess I guess it didn't. No one had to issue a ruling on me. And in any case, I was a part of a troop that I don't think cared very much, and was probably, well, I know from talking to the scoutmaster, frustrated at the Boy Scouts' official policy. So, but I was one of those people who, when the Boy Scouts took their right, you know, to discriminate against gay members all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, I was one of the people who put my Eagle Scout badge in the mail and sent it back to Texas. I did not want to be connected to an organization that would not have me because of my sexuality. I just thought it was a really crazy policy, particularly because the Boy Scouts draw in young people at an age before they, most of them, will have figured out their sexuality. So you can, it is impossible to ban gay members from Scouts. It's just not a practical idea, and it's just going to, well, it would have now that it's been reversed, but it would have just continually been harmful to gay members of Scouts and just stupid. And so the organization now has evolved a bit. They will allow gay members, but not gay leaders, which is also stupid.
Well, it goes, as I understand it, at 18, if you are openly gay, and openly gay is the way to say it, you're out.
So I guess, yeah, so I don't know what they would say about me at this point. They would, I guess I retroactively maybe could have been out in the Scouts as a gay scout, and it would have been fine if it was to happen now. But once I, now, now, if I was to, you know, want to be involved in a scout troop or something like that, I wouldn't be allowed. And so what I hear them saying is that gay people under 18, no problem. But once you turn 18 as a gay man, you become a pedophile. I think that is their that is the only sense I can make of it, which is insane. In Washington State, for example, gay adults are allowed to marry. They're allowed to adopt children. There's no rational basis for the kind of policy that the Boy Scouts are implementing. And it's just, again, setting a really retrograde, poor example for their members.
And I think that you actually are no longer an Eagle Scout, Eli. Because I think that what happens is the policy has this sort of obsolescence built into it, and I think it will eventually, or maybe sooner than later, collapse. Because, as I understand it, once you turn 18, they kick you out of the Scouts. It's right. Not just that you can't be a Scout Master; it's that
you're done.
You're done. So
yeah,
turn in your badge.
I don't know. My orientation to it is that I earned this thing. And it was a good experience for me. So whether they say that I am or not is one thing, and how I see it is another thing.
Can you tell me what it takes to be an Eagle Scout? I mean, that's like the top scout, right? Top.
Yeah.
What do you have to do?
I think it varies a little bit. But, you know, the troop that I was a part of in Seattle was it was more outdoorsy than a lot of troops and less kind of religiously focused in some parts of the country. Scouting is very connected to churches. This was kind of secular, outdoorsy, and service oriented. And so you have to do a certain amount of public service, community service, and then you have to show that you can lead somewhat and survive on your own in the outdoors and be useful to yourself and others. And there are a lot of skills that you have to learn along the way that are useful in your life.
Sounds so much better than Girl Scout.
You want me to do the Girl Scout pledge? On my honor, I will try to do my duty to God and my country, help other people at all times, especially those at home. That's the Girl Scout motto.
I like to try to do your duty. That. And Boy Scouts is will do your duty.
Were you a scout?
I was. I was a terrible Boy Scout. I hated Boy Scouts. The era when I was a Boy Scout, all the dads had been buck privates in World War II and were determined to be General Patton in the church basement. I hated it. I thought it was full of sadists. I thought it was, you know, borderline Lord of the Flies with kind of a bad right-wing militia element.
Wow.
I won't go into a lot of detail. I've written about this a little bit. But I was assaulted by a fellow Boy Scout, sexually assaulted, while I was in Boy Scouts. It wasn't, you know, a horrendous event. I was able to fend the person off. And it never occurred to me that it was like a gay thing. The issue for me was just the sort of personal violation. It just seemed to me to represent the kind of lack of general respect and safety that seems so hypocritical to me about all these slogans we were saying, and then, you know, the way people were actually treated in the Boy Scouts.
You didn't have that experience, Eli.
I didn't have that experience, I would not wish that experience on anyone.
No.
But it's the Boy Scouts have not escaped the problem of sexual abuse of members by banning gay people.
No.
I mean, obviously, Knut's case is proof of that, and there's been a tremendous number of other cases. My experience, just to fill it out a little bit more, was more, you know, going to Mount Rainier and building igloos and sleeping in them, spending, you know, 10 days on Lake Roosevelt, going 50 miles in a canoe and rigging up sails to propel yourself as you're paddling, biking from...
Wow.
We didn't get to do this.
No.
We learned to sew.
Yes.
Biking all throughout the Salt Spring Islands of Canada and back down to Seattle.
Well, that sounds so fun.
It was fun, and those things, which should be at the center of scouting, have, as I can see it, no relationship to someone's sexuality. And I don't understand why you would prohibit members, either adults or under 18.
So is there a prohibition on lesbian scouts? I can't remember. In the Girl Scouts?
I can't remember, but it seems like there must be. But Who knows? That's a great question.
Well, I mean, we talk about the Boy Scouts all the time. Is anybody talking about the Girl Scouts?
Maybe there's no prohibition. I don't know. I'm gonna look that up as soon as I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, given that you can write about these women things on
these lady issues.
Lady. Well, I just have to jump back to the mayor because there are no women running for mayor. Just.
Well, there are three.
There are three.
Yeah.
No legitimate candidates.
Nobody.
They're real legitimate women, not legitimate candidates. Say,
they're all legitimate women.
none of them are going to make it. Who's the third?
The third is Joey Gray. She got in on the last day, and I don't know a lot about her.
So there's the two Martin women.
Yep, there's Kate Martin and Mary Martin. Kate Martin told me that she's going to have to just start calling herself Mary so that people don't get confused. We haven't had a female mayor since Bertha Knight Landis, and it's somewhat baffling. One possible reason that a consultant mentioned to me was that, when you tend to get into politics in this town, when you tend to run for mayor, it's, when you're in your, 50s, 60s, and perhaps women of that age are a little less, convinced of their own viability. And additionally, if you're not of that age, if you're, in your 30s and you have kids, running for mayor is a full-time job. You have to quit your job for a while. And, that's often harder for women.
And being mayor is hard if you're, if maybe you don't have a supportive person at home taking care of your kids. I mean, a lot of these guys running have grown kids.
Well, and I think you can probably afford
Kate Martin has young kids, doesn't she?
She has teenage kids.
Teenage kids. Yep. So that's still tough.
When we were talking about Bruce Harrell, the question that he was able to answer at the mayoral forum that the rest of the candidates flubbed was the question about pay disparity in Seattle between men and women. And so that could be another factor that women are not running as often, that they have not been earning enough and banking enough to mount a run in the way that, say, Burgess was able to finance his run with his own money for council.
It may be that women are just smart enough to know the job's a political dead end.
We have
women senators, women in Congress. We have a woman in the cabinet. I mean, there are a lot of running Sound Transit. We have all kinds of
running WashDOT.
Running WashDOT. All kinds mm-hmm. of top people. So there has to be some other reason why it selects out. It's an interesting question.
Well, just speaking of politicians, and back to the Boy Scouts, the former gubernatorial candidate is the president-elect of the Chief Seattle Council of the Boy Scouts of America. Rob McKenna is going to be running the local sort of regional Boy Scout chapter. And we talked to him yesterday. He was down in Grapevine, Texas, casting his vote to lift the ban on gay youth. I think he's still in favor of don't ask, don't tell when it comes to
no, he's not
gay leaders. He's supports the complete lifting.
My understanding is that he did, but they didn't get to vote on that part of it. But he doesn't think that's sustainable.
I don't think they're going to vote on it anytime soon. It took them a long time just to vote on this one.
Although these things have a kind of dam breaking quality to them, it is. Intellectually unsustainable and just practically unsustainable. And so if the Boy Scouts survive, which they will, with troops open to gay youth members, it will be very hard to continue to articulate a reason for this ban on adult members who are gay. And I think that will fall pretty quickly also.
Anna, let's move from the local to the national for a second. President Obama gave a major address yesterday, a policy address about drones and the supervision of the secret war on terrorism. And at least in our newsroom, we heard a heckler kind of continually throughout the speech, a woman yelling at him. But this is, is this really a reverse policy? He says the war should end, but it didn't say anything about stopping the use of drones.
Well, it's a huge shift to push, at least, and Congress will have to ultimately do this, but pushing for the end to the declaration of war that came after September 11th. We've been living officially in a state of war for 12 years, I guess. And it makes sense to end it. And Obama really, in a very long and thoughtful speech, I thought, articulated good reasons for doing it, essentially that we've gone back to the threat level that existed before September 11th. And so we can change that. And in terms of drones, he said, although he didn't describe in detail that there would be a higher threshold for drone strikes outside the Afghan theater, that they would continue in Afghanistan as long as U.S. forces are there, which is not going to be all that much longer, supposedly. And then outside, for example, in Yemen, where the administration just admitted to killing American citizens in a drone strike. Was it in Yemen? Am I remembering that right? There will be a much higher threshold for taking that kind of action in the future. I thought it was, all in all, a very, very unusual speech, in that you saw a president kind of thinking out loud the pros and cons and describing the binds that he's in, and showing really how he arrived at the points that he arrived at as kind of the least worst options out of a lot of very bad options and hard choices. It's worth listening to. It'll take an hour of your time, but it's worth listening to, given that it covers the state of our country for the last 12 years. And he did a very elegant job of weaving in the descent of the heckler. At the end, he talked about how he respects her alarm. That he basically said people should be alarmed at some of what has gone on over the last year since September 11th in terms of the expansion of the security state, the ability of the government to eavesdrop, Guantanamo, which was her issue, and which he was trying to say while she was heckling him, he would try again to close. We'll see if he's able to do it. But he then, at the very end, at the close of his speech, in a very elegant way, as he was kind of ticking through the just mundane day-to-day aspects of living in a free society, or living in America as a free citizen, he added her dissent, her, you know, yelling at the president as one of those things that is made possible by, you know, thoughtful defense of the country. And so it's I'm not doing as good a job at as restating it as he did when he stated it, but it was a very elegant, thoughtful, nuanced speech that is worth listening to. And even the dissent to the speech in real time was welcomed in real time.
I just have to say, we got like a flood of listener email, not about drones, but about scouts. And most people are saying that the Girl Scouts never discriminated against lesbian members. So to go from drones to that, all of a sudden there was like a spurt of things.
Thank you for that, listeners.
Yes, and do not diss the Girl Scouts, people. you know, it. I would have
got two Girl Scouts sitting here.
Yeah, I would have liked to have been biking around Salt Spring Island and making igloos. I'm going to leave you all thinking about Obama and mayoral races and bridges and funding. And just to thank the panel, Erica C. Barnett, news editor at Publicola at Seattle Met. Nice to have you in today. Very fun to have two women in the studio. Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. And once again, if you are thinking on this Memorial Day weekend of heading north or south on I-5 through Mount Vernon, here is WashDOT's Mike Allende giving you the reroute.
For southbound, people are exiting at exit 230, which is State Route 20. They'll go to South Burlington Boulevard, then to East College Way. Back to southbound I-5. For northbound, they'll exit at exit 227, which is College Way, to Riverside Drive, on to South Burlington Boulevard to George Hopper Road, and then back to I-5.
Okay, if you didn't get all that, you can either log on to the Washington State Department of Transportation website, where they say they're going to have a big box in red that gives you directions, or you can go to KUOW.org. We'll be posting on our website as well. Our reporter, Derek Wong, is up in the Mount Vernon area, and we'll be bringing you the latest twists and turns of that bridge collapse here on 94.9 KUOW. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, Andy Hurst, Rob Wood engineered today. I'm Marcy Silman. Have a great Memorial Day weekend. Stay home.
quick check of the headlines coming up in just a minute. This is KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. We're online at KUOW.org.
When author Richard Rubin tracked down the last veterans of World War I, he unearthed long-lost stories.
They were telling me things that they hadn't talked about in 50, 60, 70 years. I asked a few of them, why not? And the surprising response often was that nobody had asked.
The Last of the Doughboys, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's just one of the things you'll hear during our afternoon news magazine today from 3 to 7 o'clock.
Support from Washington State Patrol.
55 degrees overcast right now in Seattle's University District. Our forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies today. We're looking at about a 40% chance of showers for the rest of the day. We'll have a high of 59. It'll be cloudy with rain possible tonight. We'll see a low of about 48 degrees. Checking the rest of the Memorial Day weekend, should be mostly cloudy tomorrow with a slight chance of some.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.